That seemed really appropriate to introduce Aaron McKee, who is our speaker this morning, co-founder of the Oregon Justice Resource Center and one of their immigration attorneys. I had the pleasure of meeting Aaron some time ago, and following a long talk, we decided that this was definitely a place for her to come and speak about the humanitarian aspects and the humanitarian reflections on Oregon's sanctuary status. When Aaron was younger, she was a feminist human rights NGO in India. She interned there for a time, and when she asked her mentor if she could stay and continue the work, she was politely told to go home and help fix her own country. So in furtherance of that mission, she eventually went to law school at Lewis and Clark and is driven, truly driven, by the belief that the justice system should be accountable to all of us and that we should be accountable to each other, regardless of borders. Regardless of borders. Aaron McKee, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak this morning, and a special thank you to Salima, who has just been a joy to meet and encounter and talk with, and is, I think, a treasure for your fellowship. She's got the spark, for sure. Salima mentioned that I'm one of the co-directors and an immigration attorney at our Immigrant Rights Project. And at the Immigrant Rights Project, what we do is work specifically at the intersection of criminal law and immigration law. What has come to be called, I better make sure I don't run on too long, crimmigration. And I'm going to say that again because I'm always asked. Crimmigration. In the narrowest sense, and what our daily work consists of, crimmigration involves analyzing the immigration consequences of pleas and convictions. And we're actually funded by the state to do this, which is great, which is one way that Oregon has really shown and in practice is a sanctuary state. And the reason, the real reason the state funds this is because in 2010, the Supreme Court held that the failure to provide this kind of advice violates the Sixth Amendment statute to effective assistance of counsel. And this advice is critical because a seemingly minor offense can have devastating consequences for an immigrant. For example, I once had a client who was a refugee from Iraq, and she received her green card. And one day she was at the store. She was going to purchase some hair barrettes for her granddaughter. And she's standing in line at the register, ready to pay. And while she's standing there, she receives a phone call informing her that her son in Iraq had just died in a car bombing. She is understandably shocked and devastated, and without even thinking, she walks out of the store with the barrettes still in her hands. She's stopped by security, who calls the police for whatever insane reason, and she is charged with theft. She was so ashamed. So ashamed of being arrested and of going through that process that she just took the plea to get it over with, not realizing that it actually made her deportable from the United States. When she came to me, she wanted to apply for citizenship. We were fortunate in her case that at that time I was able to convince the government not to refer her to deportation proceedings back then. The various immigration officers had a lot more discretion than they do now, unfortunately. And we were able to successfully get her citizenship. But again, this was several years ago, and I think the outcome would be different today. In a broader sense, crimmigration refers to the criminalization of migration itself, increased use of immigration detention, and private prisons, increased criminal prosecution at the border for illegal entry and the subsequent family separation that we've all seen in the news, and a deportation process that one prominent immigration judge compared to holding death penalty cases in traffic court settings. Immigration and sanctuary laws and policies, the topic of today's conversation, are related issues, which is why I'm setting the stage with that. Today I'll be specifically addressing Oregon's status as a sanctuary state from a humanitarian perspective, and I also will leave plenty of time for questions afterwards that can be generally any kind of immigration-related questions, because I do get a lot of this. But as far as thinking about being a sanctuary state and thinking about what it means to be to look at it as a humanitarian, part of being an effective humanitarian is being informed. So I think the first order of business is figuring out what we mean when we say sanctuary. It's a very loaded term these days. Sanctuary has become a political rallying cry on both sides of the aisle, either condemned as emboldening criminal immigrants and jeopardizing national security, or praised as protecting immigrants from aggressive immigration enforcement and ICE. And neither characterization is quite right. I'll come back to this. This is the main theme. But I'm going to provide some historical context first, so you're going to get a history lesson today. So the original sanctuary movement was an effort spearheaded by churches in the 1980s who gave refuge to primarily Guatemalans and Salvadorans fleeing the brutal civil wars at the time. Then it wasn't sanctuary jurisdictions in the news, it was sanctuary congregations. Various denominations were involved. I'm sure you're not surprised, you probably know, unsurprisingly, including Unitarian Universalists. These churches literally provided sanctuary by giving food, shelter, medical aid, and access to legal advice to asylum seekers who were otherwise going to be deported by what was called INS at the time, Immigration and Naturalization Services. At that time, sanctuary was primarily about the right to seek asylum, and immigrant advocates argued that the Central Americans fleeing civil war should be protected by the relatively new Refugee Act of 1980 at that time. It was not lost on activists then, and it should not be forgotten now that the U.S. government at that time supported those oppressive Guatemalan and Salvadoran regimes that waged war against their own people. This was part of the Cold War effort to minimize the communist influence in the region. And there are many parallels to what's happening today. Much like today, the federal government labeled the asylum seekers as economic migrants and was set to deport them. But the sanctuary movement then grew across the country. It started in Arizona and Texas, but it spread across the country. And church leaders and community members didn't back down. Some were even convicted of federal felonies for the aid that they provided to these refugees. The sanctuary movement in the 1980s was about letting people in, and the sanctuary movement of now is about letting people stay. So right now there are more than 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, and roughly 70% have been here for 10 years or more. They are part of our communities. They are integral to our economies. They include those who are brought here as children, our dreamers, young people who are Americans in every way except on paper. I always tear up about DACA because I really cut my teeth on those DACA applications, and those are my first clients. And I had hundreds of DACA clients who are now all in danger of being deported. Trump and other anti-immigrant voices like to talk a lot about how dangerous immigrants are, how MS-13 members are animals, how we are essentially being invaded by criminals. And I'm not saying that MS-13 isn't real, that some immigrants that no one commits crimes, and that some of those MS-13 members haven't committed some very gruesome crimes. It's true. But the threat of gang violence and violent crimes committed by undocumented immigrants, or any kind of crime for that matter, committed by immigrants, has been greatly, greatly exaggerated. In fact, immigrants commit crimes at much lower rates than native-born citizens. And as the immigrant population in a metro area increases, crime rates decrease. There are many facts and studies and statistics to back this up. But to understand and to push against the racist rhetoric about immigrants and crime, the phenomenon of criminal gangs like MS-13 also needs to be put into historical context and actually parallels issues from the First Sanctuary Movement. And so we're already starting to see how complicated the historical and social context of these issues are, and so then how easy it is for some people, some leaders and politicians to just gloss over that and kind of hang their hats on flashy and violent and fear-mongering rhetoric. So I'm going to give you a little lesson on MS-13 now, because Trump likes to just go on and on about this gang, this criminal organization. And it is a criminal organization, but most people don't realize that MS-13 is a homegrown problem, as in homegrown in the United States. So some of those same Salvadoran youth that fled to the U.S. seeking asylum in the 1980s, some of those kids, ended up in L.A., and they were not welcomed there. They were marginalized by the majority, and they faced a lot of hostility from other ethnic groups at the time. So they started to stick together. And they began more as a social group of teens who liked rock music and marijuana. In the 1990s, California passed, like many of the states, there was a huge push for very harsh criminal justice, tough-on-crime measures, the war on drugs, etc. California passed laws mandating life sentences for a third felony, which is insane, and allowing minors to be charged as adults if they were determined to be gang members. And who knows how that determination was made. The prisons quickly filled up with young Latino men, in addition to young black men and other folks of color. In prison, the young Salvadorans, again, had to stick together. And they learned to be very, very tough, and they learned how to organize from some of the other inmates in our own prison systems. In 1996, the immigration laws changed greatly, greatly, greatly expanding the criminal grounds of deportation, so that now, again, minor crimes, like my client's petty theft conviction, made people deportable from the United States. Between 2000 and 2004, approximately 20,000 young men with criminal records were deported to El Salvador. This was a country still trying to rebuild its infrastructure after the Civil War, and all these young men who were organized now and had learned in U.S. prisons that violence equals power, they were dropped into this power vacuum, where after the Salvadoran government unsuccessfully tried to crack down on them, including extended and harsh imprisonment without due process, they were able to exert their power. They filled that vacuum. They did start to really kind of take over villages in a way, and again terrorize their own people and exert significant control. So that's how this gang that Trump likes to talk about a lot got started. For the most part, MS-13 members have stayed in El Salvador, partly leading to the surge of unaccompanied minors in 2014. If you all remember, a few years ago, there were many, many unaccompanied minors coming primarily from the Central Triangle countries, including El Salvador, and they were, for the most part, fleeing the kind of gang violence and fleeing their homes had become war zones de facto. So while some MS-13 members have made it to the United States, their numbers are only between 6 and 10,000, which is relatively low. So although these numbers are low, and again, not to downplay the nature of their crimes or to dismiss the victims of those crimes, but statistically, the numbers are low, both in terms of gang members and crimes committed by undocumented immigrants in general. But for a lot of people, the issue of immigration, and why I think that it is such a difficult, one of the reasons it's a difficult issue for people to grasp and to figure out and for us to talk about civilly, is that for a lot of people, it's not a head issue, it's a heart issue. It's not about the facts for a lot of folks, it's about a feeling. It's about a feeling of being unsafe, a feeling that one's identity, the essence of who they are, is threatened by the presence of a foreigner. This is the conclusion I've come to after having many conversations rooted in logic and numbers and rationale, and trying to appeal to humanitarian values as well, but saying, even if you don't have, you know, the big Unitarian Universalist heart, it makes sense that we should have different policies. People really resist against that, and I think people feel really, really threatened about that. And just like the criminal justice system, where harsh criminal justice policies, like the war on drugs, were designed to appeal to white middle-class voters, although the effects were largely felt by a community of colors, harsh immigration policies do the same thing. So all of this is just to provide some background and context for the new sanctuary movement, the now sanctuary movement. There is no legal definition of sanctuary. Today's sanctuary laws are widely understood to mean any law that limits local and state governments' role in federal immigration enforcement. I actually find the term sanctuary problematic because I think it leads to a false sense of security. People think this is a sanctuary state, so I'm safe, or my family is safe from ICE. Or this is a sanctuary city, so I don't have to worry about those horrible things happening here. This is incorrect. Labeling a place as a sanctuary jurisdiction is a symbolic act only. And while symbolism is absolutely important, and what our leaders say, that matters, it is important. But words without action, that's just not enough. Now, the Trump administration has its own definition of sanctuary. It initially labeled any jurisdiction that complied with ICE detainers as a sanctuary jurisdiction and then threatened to withhold government funding from those places. Multiple courts have found that compliance with ICE detainers is unconstitutional. And so most jurisdictions fell into that label of sanctuary jurisdiction. I thought it was hilarious. Clark County, Washington met that definition and so was on this list of sanctuary jurisdictions. And the sheriff there, this is how much symbolism matters, right? The sheriff there actually released a press statement saying, no, we're not a sanctuary jurisdiction. And again, it didn't really mean anything either way. So that was just a political act. In a lot of ways, like just saying you're a sanctuary city can sometimes just be a political act as well. Now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has had to walk back from that initial definition of a sanctuary jurisdiction, and now it has a very, very narrow definition according to the Trump administration, which essentially is any jurisdiction that fails to comply with a specific federal statute. And this federal statute prohibits local and state governments and agencies from enacting laws or policies that limit communication with the feds solely about immigration status. It's an old law, and it's a very narrow law, and most jurisdictions have already been in compliance with it for many, many years. So very few, if any, jurisdictions now meet Trump's new definition of sanctuary jurisdiction. All that said, we do still colloquially now use and understand a sanctuary law, again, to mean a law that limits local cooperation with federal immigration enforcement, or more accurately, limits states and state and local governments from enforcing immigration law, right? That's not their job. They keep states doing their job and the feds doing their job. Oregon has one of the oldest, if not the oldest, I think it is the oldest, statewide sanctuary laws in the country. It prohibits law enforcement from using state or local resources to actually enforce federal immigration law. Specifically, state resources can't be used for the purpose of detecting or apprehending persons whose only violation of law is that they are removable from the United States. So it basically means that local law enforcement can't detain someone just because they suspect they're here unlawfully or undocumented. If they detain someone, it has to be because they have reasonable suspicion that person committed a state or local crime. The impetus of this law, was an incident of racial profiling when a longtime Oregon resident and U.S. citizen of Mexican descent was publicly interrogated about his immigration status in a humiliating scene where a local deputy grabbed him in a restaurant, made him stand in front of everyone while he was questioned about his immigration status. And I believe this was in Independence, Oregon. You all know Oregon better than I do. Unsurprisingly, that man sued. Thankfully, he also won. And thereafter, they passed this law, our sanctuary statute. Based on the reasoning of wanting to prevent blatant racial profiling and also to limit state and local liability. Because, of course, that county had to pay a lot of money for that kind of behavior. The law had broad bipartisan support when it was passed in 1987. And that point of wanting to limit liability was important then, and it's not really something that gets a lot of play in the media now, and I think it's a good talking point for those who want to keep our sanctuary law, that one of the main reasons is immigration law is really complicated, and you can train a local police officer about it, but there are so many quirks and so much room for error. And you can bet if they wrongfully detain someone again, we'll win, and we'll ask for a lot of money. So I think that we should support our sanctuary law for many reasons, but not the least of which really is limit liability. So if you're looking for a talking point with your friends and family, that's one I would lead with. And I'm talking about talking points because, as most of you know, today that law is under very serious threat. A longtime anti-immigrant group Oregonians for Immigration Reform, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has designated as a hate group, put forth a ballot measure to repeal the sanctuary statute. The ballot measure is also supported by Oregon House Representative Mike Nierman, who happens to be the vice president of this group. Recently, 16 Oregon sheriffs also signed a letter in support of the measure to repeal it as well. It was an incredibly disturbing letter. Most of it was illogical and the rest was just incorrect. And it's troubling. It's very troubling to hear our leaders make these misinformed statements. And it's a disservice to voters who are trying to make heads or tails of the issue. I'm a staunch pro-immigrant rights advocate. That's what I've dedicated my life to. But I understand that people have different values, and of course we should value national security and all these things and safety. And people prioritize their values differently. That's okay for us to disagree about things, but we need to all at least be starting from the same basis of fact and correct information. When people hear I'm an immigration attorney, depending where I am, but around these parts, at least around Portland, most people ask, how can I help? What can I do? And right now in Oregon, the answer is so easy. Vote no on 105. No on 105. After we win that fight, there are many other local laws and policies that we can change and create to protect the rights of non-citizen Oregonians. And that's really what being a sanctuary jurisdiction is about, is creating rules and laws that show we care, and that we're that the rights of all matter to us. Right. The other idea I hope you walk away from a takeaway. First takeaway is no on 105 and tell your friends. Second takeaway is thinking about how to distinguish the rhetoric of sanctuary from the work of sanctuary. And some folks have tried to get around the inherent issues with the term sanctuary by replacing it with the term disentanglement. I think that's better. But maybe we should get away from talking about sanctuary and disentanglement altogether, because we don't really need new words for what's happening right now. Because this isn't a new problem, right? It's injustice. It's systemic racism. And in some cases, overt racism with animus. And it may be manifesting and new and novel ways because of an aggressively nationalist administration and its supporters. But at its core, it's nothing new, and we need to call it what it is. If we're serious about being humanitarians and acknowledging the basic human dignity inherent to all of us, then we need to push against the idea that only certain people deserve justice, U.S. citizens and everybody else. We need to push against the idea that there are even deserving immigrants and non-deserving immigrants. This is antithetical to the definition of justice. We can't pick and choose when justice applies or when justice matters. Justice matters all the time, every second, to all of us, regardless of immigration status. And holding firmly to this basic truth is the first step in realizing and making real the spirit of sanctuary. That's kind of my lay of the land for what sanctuary looks like in Oregon and how we came here and all of the complicated issues and context that goes with it.